Hello and welcome to Essential Dissent, coming to you from the last days of the U.S. Empire. I'm Wilton Vaught, producer of the series. This episode is a talk by Douglas Rushkoff in conversation with Marissa Feinberg. It took place at the Francis Kite Club in New York City on November 3, 2024. The Francis Kite Club is also the home of Orr Books, which recently published an updated edition of Douglas Rushkoff's book, Program or Be Programmed. According to the book's blurb, updated with a new section on the unique challenges posed by AI, Program or Be Programmed presents a spirited, accessible poetics of the new media. The question is, do we direct technology or do we let ourselves be directed by it and those who have mastered it? Choose the former, writes Rushkoff, and you gain access to the control panel of civilization. Choose the latter, and it could be the last real choice you get to make. In 11 Commands, Rushkoff provides cyber enthusiasts and technophobes alike with the guidelines to navigate this new universe. And from Rushkoff's bio, named one of the world's 10 most influential intellectuals by MIT, Douglas Rushkoff is an author and documentarian who studies human anatomy in a digital age. His 20 other books include Survival of the Richest, Team Human, which is based on his podcast, Present Shock, and Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus. He also made the PBS Frontline documentaries Generation Like, The Persuaders, and Merchants of Cool. He won the Marshall McLuhan Award, as well as the Neil Postman Award for Career Achievement in Public Intellectual Activity. He is director of the MA program in Media Studies at the City University of New York, Queens College. Marissa Feinberg is the founder of Psychedelics for Climate Action. Please note that the views expressed on Essential Dissent are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent my own views or those of this radio station. Also, the speakers in this episode occasionally discuss and sometimes advocate the use of various illegal drugs.
So, Doug, how was this book first received and why bring it back now?
All right. So, Programmer Be Programmed, 10 Commands for a Digital Age, came out in 2010. Right. So, this is like the 15th year anniversary. And when it came out, I mean, it's hard to remember what it was like then. It was different. People saw it as kind of a STEM advocacy book, right? Programmer be programmed. So if you're not learning to code, then you're not participating in the world, right? So this was a book that was meant sort of as a way of applying the liberal arts critical studies perspective to digital technology, to say that if you don't understand what this world is programmed to do to you, then you are going to be more at the mercy of it if you're not actively programming as opposed to being programmed. But yeah, so it became like a part of the clarion call of STEM and learn to code, and the military liked it because they thought it would help get more people who could program drones and compete with Iranian kids who were, you know, hacking our drones and things like that. So it was taken literally. Right? Programmer, literally, because we were living even then in this, what we're in now, this literal culture, the reality TV culture that had lost the ability to understand metaphor or allegory or anything other than, you know, we had already been reduced. We were in some sense so reduced by the quantization sort of bias of digital technology and reality TV and the loss of story and narrative and metaphor that they saw that part of it, which is fine. I mean, at least I sold a bunch of books and it's nice and short, so people assigned it in high school. But then the kids who would read it in high school would send me an email and they'd say, so you're not really in favor of all this technology, are you? You know, it's like, no. So, oh, because our STEM, you know, code teacher gave us this book and he just wants us to 3D print things. But you're kind of saying maybe we should think twice about 3D printing everything, right? Yeah, you got it. It's okay. Yeah.
All right. So with this new edition, was this an opportunity to correct that, or what did you change or add?
Well, it was weird. I mean, I had started to get a lot of emails from people who were rediscovering the book, partly because of the AI thing. Right now, as I see it, AI is just digital technology presented in a way that people can go, oh, that's what this stuff does, right? That's what this does. It reconfigures itself in real time based on us. It was sort of algorithms kind of help people see it, but now they go, oh, AI is what this was from the beginning. That's all it was. That's where it's been going. So when I was writing program back then, I was saying, we are living in a landscape that is programmed to influence us, that is changing based on who we are and what we do. It's reconfiguring itself. You know, like you can turn your head and it's like, ooh, it's, you know, it's creating that reality. It's rendering as we go. And people didn't quite get that. And now that AI came around, people are, then they're saying, oh, I kind of get it. So they've returned to this book or found this book as, because that's what the book was trying to explain, what this landscape was going to be like that we were moving into. And now I feel like they were understanding it more in the way I had intended it, that we have to understand how to, you know, retrieve and bring forward our ethics and our humanity and our social lives and all that in a landscape that's functioning in very different ways, that has very different biases to it. So yeah, it was like, oh, let's, and then I was like talking to Colin and I was like, let's just bring this out again. This is still, you know, my sort of evergreen book and it's short, right? So it's like people actually read it. I'm happy that people put my books on their coffee tables, but I'm even happier if they make the time to read the thing. And since it's like less than a plane trip, people actually do. I was like, let's do this again and recontextualize it just a little bit, you know, add some sort of AI stuff so it's a little more explicit.
So speaking of evergreen books, there's an overlap, at least in the original Ten Commands, with the Bible.
Yeah.
Is that deeper than the title?
Oh, yeah. That was the whole thing. I mean, where do I even go? AI. In the early digital days, people were either like Wired magazine digital boosters or sort of more, you know, Verso books, Esalen style digital haters. And it was really hard to find people, what I call kind of techno-realists. And there were a few of us who were like, okay, this stuff could be really good or it could be really bad, depending on how well we understand it and what we do with it. You know, that you know, technology is not the problem, capitalism is. Or technology is not the problem, people are. You know, email's not the problem, it's the emailers are. It's the expectations of the other humans that are going to drive this. So I was looking for who has dealt before with a major civilization-wide media transition, right? Who's dealt with moving from one media environment into another? And as I, because I'm a media theorist, as I read Torah, Bible, that's what the story is, right? The Axial Age, we know it, we got farming in the Axial Age, so you can look at Torah, and most people do, at the Bible as, okay, there are these wandering kind of Bedouin shepherd people who are now going to become farmer people. And it's like, how do you maintain the ethics of an itinerant, moving, indigenous, circular, rhythmic people, a lunar people, and become sedentary and have land and farming and ownership and all these things? How do you deal with that transition? But the other thing that happened in the Axial Age was the invention of writing, of text. So the way I looked at Torah was, how do you deal with, how does an oral culture, where everything that is negotiated live in real time, where stories are recalled and shared orally and can be adapted by each generation moving forward, where everything is oral and liquid and social and real time, and now we're going to write things down. So all of a sudden, our history, instead of being an orally negotiated story, the history, it's written down. There it is. That's what happened. And your future, instead of it being something that we negotiate together, your future is now written down as a contract. I mean, that's what they called Torah, is called a covenant, which basically means a contract between a people and God for what's going to happen. So it's a way of predicting the future. But if you're ethically now, an oral people are moving into a world of written contracts, so now I can write something that's going to make an agreement between you and me, and in a year or two, when that agreement actually comes to fruition, I'm going to be over in Nova Scotia, and you're going to have to deal with the consequences of this contract. you're not going to be able to knock on my door and say, hey, this deal isn't working out for me, because now it's set in stone, it's written down. So what I look at Torah as, and then the Talmud and all the laws that came after that, is the Israelites saying, okay, how are we going to bring forth our understanding of God and community and nation and morality and ethics, and how are we going to bring that forward in this world where we're no longer talking face-to-face, or we're going to have this thing? So we got these commandments, right, which are sort of from God, or these are the commandments of how you can live an appropriate life. Flash forward to now, we're transitioning from a print and broadcast media environment to an interactive one. So what do we do? Well, rather than having commandments, right, that come down to us from God or from the paper, from the Ten Commandments, we're going to have commands. And that was my way of trying to say that the way to move through this new realm is to maintain and restore your agency in the face of autonomous technologies. So where is your agency? So each of the Ten Commands were like, no, these are ways that you learn to command technology rather than commandments. So I was trying to kind of flip it into the active. But yeah, I saw it as not this work, but the intention, you know, as profound, as important as that of the Bible. And hopefully it'll work better than the Bible did for creating a moral people.
Mm. Wow. You know, those commands too, so you're not programming or be programmed, right? Yeah.
Right.
So you've also talked about digital technology in psychedelic terms. Has that been literal or figurative?
It started out totally literal. My best psychedelic friends from college, you know, I was a theater person, right? Right into my early 30s. My best friends, the most psychedelic, deadheady, crazy, Eno people, were moving from New York and New Jersey to San Francisco to become programmers at like Sun. And when one guy was at Northrop Grumman and Apple and all these places, I'm like, what the f-? I thought of computer people, and I did computers in junior high school because I was somewhat nerdy. They were like the pocket protector glasses geeks, the guys who turn the corners in the hall. You know those guys in the, that do the absolute right angles as if that's more efficient? It's like, dude, it's not. Curve, you don't go with it. Diagonals are good. But they're the robotic people. And I was like, why are psychedelics people going? So I was writing articles at the time to support my theater career, because back then you could make money. Colin, you can make money as a writer. There are places like GQ or Penthouse would pay $2 or $3 a word for an article about something that they didn't know about. So I would go out to San Francisco and write articles about my crazy friends who were working at Sun during the day and then going to Oakland at night and scraping the peyote buds off a cactus and tripping their butts off, and then making like fractal designs that would then be broadcast or projected at a Grateful Dead show or a rave the next night. So my initial journalistic kind of claim to fame was uncovering that companies were intentionally hiring psychedelics people to develop their interfaces, because psychedelics people were not afraid to hallucinate things into reality. Things like hypertext, like now I'm here, now I'm in Japan, now I'm in this part of this book, now I'm in that. It didn't freak them out because they had, you know, psychedelics people have experienced that the plasticity of reality, right? The different, that we can be in different reality tunnels and the way we structure things. You know, we were just talking about art of memory and memory cathedrals and palaces. They were used to navigating these hallucinatory landscapes. So they were depended upon to make this stuff. So yes, literally, actually psychedelic people were doing it. And the culture of San Francisco, where this was happening, was the culture of Stuart Brand and the Whole Earth Review and Mondo 2000. And so the culture around the early computer use, the really the set and setting, if you want to use psychedelic terms, the set and setting of the early internet was our collective capacity for collaborative, imaginative activity. We were all reading things like the Gaia Hypothesis by James Lovelock, which says that the planet, it was one organism, and now the internet was going to be this kind of way of wiring up all the neurons in the great global brain. So it had, you know, deeply psychedelic intentions and set and setting. And even, you know, I was friends with Timothy Leary at that point and was with him the first time he went on Mosaic, basically the first web real web browser, visual web browser. And the first thing he said was, this is ACID. This is as powerful as that, more powerful than ACID, because people don't have to take it in order to do it. So we recognized it as the psychedelic substrate, but we lost control of the set and setting. Right, the original set and setting of imagination and collaboration and realization of the great Gaian possibility was replaced by this sort of more Wired magazine, Dayglow business objective of the long boom and infinite exponentialism and all that kind of exponential transhumanist effective altruist garbage that we're suffering through today. And that's why I've been saying, you know, we've been living on an essentially psychedelic substrate for the last 30 years, but with a set and setting of surveillance, control, domination, colonization, and no wonder we're all having a bad trip now. But again, it's just because we're being programmed, because we turned the thing into a Skinner box, right? So we're being programmed, but we have the opportunity to program reality to our heart's content. You know, whether it's our history, like we were just talking about before, you can change your history by understanding it differently, and we can change the future by acting differently in the present.
Wow. So if we can program our reality now, and we look at, say, the psychedelics ecosystem, which is emerging, mm-hmm. you know, what can we learn with that ecosystem from digital and what has transpired, especially in terms of set and setting?
It's interesting, isn't it? Those of you who may be into psychedelics and are watching, you know, first the legalization of pot, and now a pot. My daughter says not to say pot, I'm supposed to say weed, sorry. Legalization of weed, the availability of mushroom circles and everything else that's going on, the potential legalization of plant medicines in Massachusetts, I just saw in Lucid News. Read and support Lucid News, by the way. You know, that you might be able to just do mushrooms legally in Massachusetts and even share some with your friends. It has that same feeling of hope that we did in the early 90s when people were no longer laughing at those of us who used computers. There was a time when if you said to your parents, you're going to get involved in digital technology, they would worry for you. Like you were going to, like, oh, I want to be a professional Dungeons and Dragons game master or something. They would worry for you if you said you wanted to get into computers. And then in the early and mid 90s, we're like, oh, the world's kind of catching on. This stuff's important. They're actually asking us how to put a token ring together, or how to get online, or, you know, what an ISP is. Oh, you know, this is going to be interesting. You know, remember when your mom got on the internet, it was just like, oh, this is going to be something. So there's that moment, that psychedelic moment is very similar to that moment, except the other thing that's similar to that moment is like Peter Thiel and guys trying to create analogs of natural substances in order to patent them and then sell them and regulate them. The corporate capitalist hunger to exploit psychedelic, let's call them technologies, just for the metaphor, psychedelic technologies for command and control is equal or greater, because they've just been through the net. They want to do the same thing. And it's the same two bad things, right? One is to own the molecules, right? To own the IP, right, on it. And the two is to control and change our behavior with that IP, right? So it's the same recipe, but I feel like this time we kind of have to see around that and recognize where our potential PowerPoints, you know, where PowerPoint, that's funny. But where are the places that we can maintain agency over things like agriculture? They can't own the same way they can own Amazon Web Servers. So we really have to look at how do we retain the homebrew, decentralized web aspect of a psychedelic society. And it might not be by getting the same kinds of centralized confirmations or affirmations that we were looking for with the net.
So I'm going to come back to that with an additional question at the end. But with our questions we have planned, you know, you end with a chapter on programming the world. And so that does sound, you know, if we look at things from a psychedelic perspective with oneness and connectedness, that does sound a little top down, no?
Yeah. And I meant it that way. As like, oh, you got programming the world. How could you say programming the world after that? After all this stuff about bottom up and we, you know, program ourselves? Right? That's the point. It's if you've gotten this far, it means that you should look at that and go, huh? And then what that chapter is about is really saying, you know, the way we program the world together is by abandoning our sort of instrumentalist understanding of social change. And the best among us, and I still do it all the time, I hate it when I hear myself do it, we say things like, well, how do we get people to vote for Kamala? How do we get people to think about the climate more? How do we get people to understand psychedelics or this, right? Once you have the construction, how do we get people to, it's over. You're lost, right? Now you're thinking, how am I going to influence and change and somehow dominate the behavior of the other in a way that conforms with how I want them to be, which is 20th century television era behavioral control and influence. That's what the 20th century was about, right? Even great leaders, you know, Martin Luther King or Mandela versus, you know, Stalin and Hitler and the bad leaders, it was still the same structure, right? Follow me up the hill, let's march, ends justifies the means journey to get to the top, and then we will, you know, and so you're getting people to. And what I'm trying to do is to flip that to how do we create an environment that engenders more pro-social or less violent, less colonialist, less frightened kinds of behavior. So you're not trying to manipulate the other, you're trying to create a welcoming environment. And I kind of then systematized that in the book with these sort of four steps. We don't necessarily have time to get into now, but really what I was talking about there was, you know, to first denaturalize power, right? Help people recognize the difference between given circumstances and things that were social constructions, right? The difference between nature and stuff that we've made, which is program or reprogram's main sort of idea. And number two was that should hopefully trigger agency, right? To trigger agency among people. Three was to re-socialize people. Once your agency is triggered, you realize, oh, I can't do this alone. I need friends. I need partners. I need comrades. Or I need solidarity with others in order to do this. And I'm sort of calling that re-socialize the people, just to put that little leftist edge in there, you know, the people, rather than re-socialize people. And then finally, cultivate awe. And that's the more psychedelic one, that once you're re-socialized and you're engaging with others in the spirit of love and connection, it cultivates your awe. You have that experience of, oh, this is bigger than me. You know, and experiences of awe are what have been systematically excised from the modern Western experience. Because when you experience awe, you experience, oh, this is greater than me. It goes against all the identitarian, individualistic, consumerist mandates of the heightened individual culture of America and turns you into a social sharing, mutual aid. You realize, oh, I'm nothing without, you know, without the others. So that's sort of what I'm suggesting to people do is this more sort of community-minded. I mean, it involves, you know, it involves critical studies, it involves political action, social, you know, putting the social back in socialism, and finally reclaiming ecstatic experience.
Okay.
So it goes back to psychedelics again.
So speaking of the people and this interconnectedness, you know, programming is still a largely white tech bro framework. So where do, you know, women, indigenous peoples, and other marginalized communities fit in?
First, I don't want to think about it as where do we fit those people in, right? If you're having to fit those people in, then you've done something wrong in the first place, right? I think the way we may need to look at it is, well, where do we fit in as white, Western, technologized, wealthy capitalists? Where do we fit in to the indigenous reality of which we are a part but do not recognize? That said, remember, computing was developed by women. You know, the math we use was developed by black women. COBOL, the first real program, what's still on the space station was, what was her name? It was a woman, what was her, the woman who did developed COBOL was in the Navy, and all of her computer people were women. If you want to know who really worked on Apple, you know, you look at, there were warehouses filled of Filipino women who were the labor force behind that. If you want to know where AI comes from, look at the kids in Africa who are mining the COBOL for that, right? These are not replacing labor or indigenous exploitation. They're just insulating us further from the realities of our extractive enslavement colonialization. There's almost nothing new happening there. It's just, in some cases, the labor is just being pushed further down the food chain as the AI does higher tasks. I mean, what I'm encouraged by are, I mean, some of the, certainly the best applications of virtual reality and any of that metaverse stuff have been from indigenous people. I mean, if you actually do some research into VR, even just do VR indigenous search on Google, and you'll start to see, oh, look at this festival of indigenous people's work and that one. So what they're doing really is creating environments to try to teach us about what is migration? What does it mean to relate to nature in these other ways? What is it to experience their story? But making jobs for groups in this is very different, I think, than giving everybody the capacity to evaluate these technologies critically and decide if and how they want to participate in them, you know, so that they can understand, oh, if I'm using this and that, I'm stuck in, you know, with Sam Altman's this and Jeff Bezos' that, and I might not want to build that way. But we're seeing it. I mean, if you look at how crypto is used in Africa versus how crypto is being used in, you know, San Francisco, you'll be surprised and see how microtransactions, you know, can work. Again, it's not about how do we get them to do the thing, to participate in the thing we're doing. Or you end up back in Negroponte's one laptop per child, which ended up looking more like a colonization effort than an invitation. And the way to do it is invite them from the beginning. If you're going to start a company from the very beginning, what's the indigenous, where is my company interfacing with the real world? Right? And actually take responsibility for that. You know, you can't go very far in your thinking without seeing the people and places you're exploiting. You can't do a single ChatGPT without thinking, where's that? You know, it's like every time you do a query on ChatGPT, even if it's just for fun, right? Every time you're doing one of those, it's like you've just driven a Maserati 40 miles or something in terms of energy. It's insane. So just calm down. Yeah.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. This episode is a talk by Douglas Rushkoff in conversation with Marissa Feinberg. It took place at the Francis Kite Club in New York City on November 3rd, 2024. The Francis Kite Club is also the home of Orr Books, which recently published an updated edition of Douglas Rushkoff's book, Program or Be Programmed.
So just a couple follow-up questions, then we're going to take some from the audience. You know, you talked about one of the positive things that could come out of some of this, like VR and learning from indigenous wisdom. You know, I was struck actually particularly in your book with part of one of your chapters where you said VR was used with children. And after a number of weeks, some of the children couldn't tell the difference between reality and what they'd seen in the VR. And so, you know, humans, right, over time, accepting technology from the read-write to what we use our phones and now ChatGPT practically overnight, you know, we're so easily programmable, you know. And when you go deep into topics like this, you know, what else? I mean, I was particularly shocked to learn that you know, that children couldn't discover that reality between VR and reality. But what else in doing your research for your book surprised you or did you discover?
I mean, that one in itself was surprising. That was from Jeremy Bailenson at Stanford did these experiments where he had little kids. Some like went to see real whales and some had a virtual experience of whales. And a few weeks later, what he basically discovered is that our memories didn't learn to tag simulation differently than reality. So once it's back there, it's like, you don't know, it's just a data point. And if you've put it into the nervous system in a way that feels real, it gets remembered. The little kids thought that it really happened. So it was kind of, that was shocking. I mean, the most shocking one was in my, when I was researching survival of the richest and found out if you take a billionaire and put them in an MRI machine and show them a picture of like a starving baby, that the parts of the brain that light up for most of us don't light up for them, that compassion thing doesn't happen, you know? And it's like, is that, does that what helped them become a billionaire? Or did that happen I think, because as they became a billionaire, they had to learn to turn themselves off to the devastation, you know, that was being caused by what they do. And that's why later in life, they start to fear the event and the robots and the AI is coming for them. You know, they are more afraid of AI than we are because they're afraid that AI is going to do to them what they've been doing to us all this time, right? So it's that comeuppance, that guilt kind of a thing. I mean, I thought that the first time I saw Terminator, I was like, oh, this is a metaphor for white Western guilt about slavery. But they want to think about it in the future as a robot because it helps them not think about the past or worse, the present of what's actually going on. It's not a science fiction scenario. It's a living reality. But the weird thing about these research things is like, and I used to love them just because they're like, ooh, you put a billionaire in a MRI machine and they don't have empathy. It's like every study they do, like 5 years later, there's a reverse study that proves the opposite. So I'm kind of like over studies at this point. But, you know, they're useful like stories, but they don't really work. You know, the other thing about the kids with the VR, a good storyteller, like Shakespeare say, frames the story with, pardon, gentles all, that this stage would be the kingdom of England. Or please, you know, gentle folk, we are going to try to enact something here. Please lend us your imagination and go with us. And then at the end, we hope we haven't offended you. The story is now over. Right? They frame it as this is a story. Right? And the story is useful to you as story when it's presented as story. And when we shifted from sort of West Wing type storytelling, which was a really kind of a sad refuge for lefties during the Bush administration, but when we shifted from that to the reality TV of The Apprentice, I feel like we lost access to story, that we're looking at reality TV as if it's reality. It's flattened. There's no metaphor. There's just the aggravation. There's just the humiliation. There's not even like pro wrestling, which at least it was like, oh, we're going to, you know, there was a narrative. They tell stories over the weeks and weeks of the thing. And finally, Hulk's going to get to fight the guy who is mean to his. And we knew it was that. With reality TV, we don't. You know, and that's even more profoundly scary to me than kids not knowing that their virtual reality experience of Wales wasn't real. It's when we really don't know what's real because we've lost that critical faculty, because we've lost our access to metaphor, to story. That's why, I mean, I'm still originally a writer, right? That's why I'm sad at the loss of critical studies. I'm sad that people think that the response to a digital society is to teach STEM, when the response to a digital society should be to teach liberal arts, to teach the humanities. That's the thing that's at risk here. That's the part that makes us special. And that's, in the end, what Programmer Be Program was trying to say, was, oh, no, remember the human. You know, remember the human, because that's who we actually are.
Team human.
Yeah, go team human.
Go team human.
I know. Elon Musk says he's on team human, so I got to abandon that meme. Yeah. Oh, well. It was worth something for a while. No, he can be on it. Teach him.
So speaking of the human, you know, in one of your chapters, you describe our digital experiences are out of body. And, you know, that's particularly something that strikes me, you know, when I'm behind my laptop a lot of the day, I sometimes do feel like very cut off from my body, much different than I feel in this room with all of these people and stimulation and conversation. Mm-hmm. We're empowered by technology right now with the mics and we're being live streamed, but it's much different when we interact with AI and there's like an other doing the work for us. And so to me, that made some connections, because when, you know, when people are out of body, they're having maybe less empathy for others. You know, we're in this culture with more extreme divisiveness culturally, and we're entering potentially an even more challenging time culturally.
Yeah.
So what advice do you have for people when we talk about embodiment?
I mean, it's interesting. We're so trained and decalibrated by our digital technologies that, I mean, even here, I mean, just looking at you, just looking, making eye contact with me, it's unbearable. Do you know what I mean? It's like just to actually be with another person and look at them, oh my God, it's like whoosh. And I mean, you know, boy or girl, old or young, child or whatever, it's like, it's just overwhelming. And I mean, that's my best advice to anybody dealing with the digital and with the digital onslaught and with decalibration is try, it's hard. 2 seconds a week, That's all. Take 2 seconds every week to actually look at another person's eyes. You know, and or if you can do 5 or 10, it's even better. You know, to get 2 full breath cycles. If you can do 2 full breath cycles looking at another person, doesn't have to be your lover, your mother, your baby, just any person, 2 breath cycles looking at another person recalibrates your nervous system. That's kind of all it takes. And if you can do that, you'll be able to get another hour on some network to get that work done or watching more TikToks or whatever it is that you're trying to do. But yeah, you digital technologies originally sort of just by happenstance, but now by design, are trying to decalibrate you because a decalibrated, disconnected, antisocial person is a better target, right? The more disoriented, fearful, confused, I mean, that's the way, it's from old NLP. It's even Ericksonian hypnosis. You create a moment of confusion to then drop in the programming, and now we live that way all the time. And when I'm saying disembodied, I mean like where our feet are up when we're using these devices, kind of our feet are up. It's like, put your feet down. Like if you are up there with your feet up and you know you're watching a movie or in VR and your feet are up and you're just floating, you move out of body into that sort of dream state. I mean, if you're feeling weird about anything, I mean, it's so simple. Just stand with your feet on the ground and breathe. All of a sudden, you're like, oh my God. Like, you're in this body and you're here. It's again, it's the same things that the Israelites are worried about text, right? Once we move from reality to a symbol system, you know, so when we're in digital, we're totally in that symbol system. So we've got to compensate for it as humans with, you know, contact with stuff. It's why people are going to ISTA and your stuff, why people are going to yoga class. And we get laughed at for going to yoga. Oh, white Westerner going to yoga class. You think you're so, you know, are we the artist, blah, blah, right? You know, they tease us for it as if it's new age. And it's like, no, it's because you got to experience your body and gravity one way or another. You know, eat, touch, stand, breathe. These are such accessible activities, technologies, and they absolutely compensate for the dematerialized, out-of-body experience of digital. So first he was talking about, you know, how I was saying agriculture is something that we can hang on to. And he says, well, yeah, what about Monsanto? Exactly. What about Monsanto? But at least when with Monsanto making genetically modified things that can then spread over to our fields and all, we can see and understand that. When I talk to college kids who are the sons of farmers in South Dakota, they understand what that is. They understand the way their no-till agriculture can be competing with Monsanto agriculture and the way that we can, you know, when corn is code, which it is in Monsanto world, how do we respond to that? But it, more interestingly, he was talking a little bit about how, you know, the text wasn't invented for, you know, the telling of stories and writing the Torah. It was invented for contracts. Exactly. And that's really what just as digital was invented for capitalism at this point, or co-opted by capitalism, text, the first things that were written down was ownership. Who owns this land? Who owns these people? It's what allowed for mass slavery on a level that hadn't happened before, because you can keep track of who owns whom. And that's really what the Torah story is telling. What the Torah story is about is the invention of debt. This young guy, Joseph, went to the Pharaoh and taught him about debt. Said, debt, there's going to be, you know, 7 years of feast and 7 years of famine. Store all the stuff during the 7 years of feast. Then everyone's going to have to come to you for the food. Then they're going to be indebted to you, and they will be indebted servants, and you will have them as slaves. Right? And that was what text allowed to keep track of people. So what Torah was trying to do is to say, no, those are not the commands we should do. Then the Israelites escape from the Pharaoh. They go to the desert. And the first thing they do is they try to write an ethical law with, you know, it's Moses and his black brother-in-law, Yithro, sit down together and write the first, they write the legal system. And that was sort of the lesson there. They no, we're going to write in a way, we're going to program our society in a way that's going to foster a social nation rather than more exploitation. That was the idea, to get away from that. But of course, we didn't. We're programming ourselves into a hole of doom. So he's saying that the client-server structure of the internet engenders the sort of subject-object exploiter-exploited reality that's emerged from it. And how do we get out of that? When I was at with Daniel, actually, when we got invited, Charlotte invited us to the Rubin Museum, and this guy was taking us around, and he was talking about meditation and all, and how we have all this you know, learned behavior and automatic reactions to things, you know, imprinted responses and all. And I was like, oh yeah, so you mean meditation can kind of get rid of those? And he's like, no, you're going to have your conditioning your whole life, but you're going to get more choice of how you respond to your conditioning, of whether you respond to it or not. You'll be able to see it, but that's staying. So when you say client-server, you know, that the internet is all client-server, well, yeah, the English language is all subject-object, right? We live in a subject-object language, which has made us noun people. Everything is a thing. Except the kids go, in America, the kids go, what's this? What's that? What's this? What's that? So if we're in a subject-object language, do we have to wipe out the language completely in order to transcend its biases? No. We simply have to understand the biases of this language and compensate for them as best we can. If you're living in Levittown or any other suburb in America that was designed specifically, intentionally, read the letters from the Levitt brothers to FDR, intentionally to prevent socializing between people living in different houses, do you have to tear down the suburbs? You know, and build a friggin', you know, Costa Rican hut village? Or do you recognize this neighborhood was built in such a way as to discourage my socialization, and I'm going to act in a way, I'm going to try to compensate for that by intentionally knocking on doors? And it's really hard to go back. And I know it's like, oh, I hear like, oh, Haskell, or Web 2. It's like, it's really hard to go back, but I don't think it's impossible to compensate for those structures moving forward. I mean, we chose binary. We didn't have to. Computers didn't have to be digital. There was a parallel path of computer technology. There was analog computer technology, which wouldn't have been quantized. It was more like a smooth analog computers. What would that have done? You know, we didn't take that road. I mean, I think we could do something else, but I think it's for now, because I'm not in Silicon Valley, for now I'm thinking the best we can do is recognize the underlying biases and then as human beings try to compensate for them as best we can. For the viewing audience, she was saying about, you know, basically the tech bros and a lot of the media conversation about AI is about, oh, them becoming all super and taking over humanity. But the reality in the moment of AI is the massive energy expenditure and that they're turning on Three Mile Island to power Microsoft. I mean, the easy way is to try to bring people back into the moment. What is happening right now? I mean, I wrote this book, Present Shock, kind of about that. The way that digital technology makes us think we've got to catch up, but actually it's catching up with us. We are in the moment of reality. What is happening now? It's, I call it one thing the dumbwaiter effect, where we build this technology that looks, you know, Thomas Jefferson does a technology that looks like it's saving labor for his enslaved servants, but it's actually just putting them out of sight and out of mind. You know, they're doing just so the food can show up automatically without the indignity of having to see the servant who actually made it for you. That's what it was about, distancing. And these technologies can do the same thing. So it's encouraging people to look at what is happening right now. That's why I say, think about what's happening when you hit go or whatever it is on ChatGPT. What are you doing in the real world? What's the actual physical impact of this on your reality? And it's like, ooh, do I want to do that? It's just far away, so you don't think about it. It's like, oh, if you could push a button and get to, you know, have a beautiful meal and sex, but somebody you don't know in China's gonna die that you'll never find out about, there's a lot of people, sure, push a button. You know, someone's gonna die in China anyway. And it's like, no, like, think, be, sit. So it's like, how do you do that? It's like psychedelics, connection to your neighborhood. It's like if you meet and like one other person, it kind of becomes harder to be mean to anybody, you know, because it's like once you've connected to the network, you start, you know, through the mycelial connections of all people. If you love one person, it's going to start moving. That's why most people who like climate, who care about climate change, it's, oh, because my kid, you know, it's like, okay, it's a start, right? Selfish, but it's a start.
Yeah. And that ties into, Douglas recently gave a talk at a Psychedelics for Climate Action event and talked about set and setting for climate activism, which ties into your theory of change we're talking about in your last chapter of your book.
Right. Because, you know, they're doing a lot of the work in psychedelics and climate is like, oh, well, people have this really intense mushroom trip or ayahuasca trip and they realize, oh, the environment is dying, you know, Mother Planet has spoken to me and now I want to you know, a lot of tech bros have this one. Now I want to, you know, come up with an algorithm that will solve the climate crisis and geoengineering. I'm going to shoot my rockets and get us off the planet. But some of them, you know, it opens their heart to that. And to me, the more important thing or equally important thing about to take from psychedelics to climate is the way to approach climate action is the same way to approach a trip, you know, which is again, how do we create a new set and setting for activism? And that was sort of those four things I was talking about, you know, helping people see the difference between natural and the created, helping trigger people's agency, re-socializing people, and then giving them experiences of awe or cultivating their ability to take in awe could engender a different kind of climate action and sensibility. What I would say, and this is the resocialization part. The resocialization part, which is the, you know, once you establish rapport with others, you have the ability to then move on to solidarity and something else. And the way we used to do it was by gathering around a charismatic leader, and now we need to do it, I believe, in a more decentralized, bottom-up fashion. So in the section, actually in the book, where I'm talking about resocializing people, I call it borrow a drill. And it came because I had to hang a picture of my daughter and this when she graduated high school. And I was like, I didn't have a drill. So what do I do? You know, what does a normal American do? You go to Home Depot and get a minimum viable product drill, you know, a nice rechargeable whatever for $49.95. You use it once, stick it in the garage, maybe take it out a year later and it won't recharge and you throw it out. So your impact on the climate, on carbon, on labor, and all, we don't have to go through it, on even the kid in Brazil who's got to pick through it at the end to find the renewable part that he can sell to Apple so that Apple can say it's green, right? And the reason why we go to Home Depot to buy the $49.95 drill is because we are afraid to walk to Bob's house and say, knock on the door and say, Bob, can I borrow your drill? Because once we go to Bob's house and borrow the drill, he's not just going to give me his drill. He's going to say, Doug, you're a wimp. You don't even know how to find a stud in the wall. I'm going to come over and drill the hole for you. And you know, he's going to bring a real drill that plugs in the wall like God intended, and put the thing in, right? And put an anchor and a stud and whatever it is you do. And hang that picture is going to stay till doomsday. Why don't I do that? Why? Because, well, if Bob does that for me, now what do I owe Bob? Right, Bob knows I'm a nerd. He knows I know math. He's seen me tutoring my kid. And now, you know, his kid's got to take an algebra regents next week. Can you come over a couple of nights and kind of help her with that? And I see that as like a burden rather than as an opportunity, rather than as a joy. Not just because it's service, but his kid's cool and his house is, his wife's going to make cookies. You know, if I let Bob help me with this picture, then when I have a barbecue graduation party for my daughter in the backyard, is Bob going to expect to come? And then if I invite Bob, then are the other neighbors going to think, well, why is Doug inviting Bob and not us? And before long, everybody on the block's going to be over at my house having a barbecue. And that's the bad thing. Right? That's the bad thing. And why do we see that as a bad thing? Not because we know it's a bad thing, because we know it's a good thing. We see it as a bad thing because we've been programmed by that individualism. So what I'm suggesting people do is to meet others in really simple ways, to engage in the lowest level forms of mutual aid. And the easier ones to do are to do nice things for other people. Like there's this elderly woman in my town and I see her from my office window and I wait till the moment that she's trying to get out of her vestibule because she's got a walker and a dog and she gets tangled up between the two doors and I get to run down there to do it and all. And I was really late to get there and this other guy was doing it. And it was like we were competing and I got it. He was the same thing, competing to have the mitzvah, right? The joy of getting to help another person, of doing something ethical. Or charitable, but it's not. You see, it's not. It gives me so much more than the other, but it's much harder for people to ask for something. Those are the real heroes, oddly enough, are the people who have the courage to ask. You know, but you think about when someone moves, not anymore, but when I was a kid, when someone would move into a neighborhood, what you would do is everyone on the block would like make them a plate of cookies or a plate of brownies, and you go over there and you give them the brownie. Do you think someone with kids on the first night in a new home wants to jack them up on sugar the same night that they've got to go to sleep for the first time in this new room? Right? No, it's not a favor. You're doing it in order to initiate them into the system of debt. You're putting them into debt to you as a favor. Now they get to do something for you. They're woven into the fabric of community by having accepted that gift. They got to bring back the plate. And you know, you're supposed to put something on the plate when you bring it back. Then you have tea and you sit and you talk. You've at least given them a reason to come back with a plate. And you've invited them over when you bring those brownies to them. So that's, you know, that's sort of, I know it sounds very small, and it is, but it's only hopefully the first step towards a participatory communal organismic experience of life on the planet, you know, but it's going to take baby steps in a desocialized digital, you know, nightmare society like we're living in. And if you are at Google, there are meetings. You're in a meeting. You can spend your time in every meeting looking for opportunities to how can this application take one more thing into account that it hasn't before, right? How can, you're designing Uber, how can this help Uber drivers talk to each other, right? Which of course Uber doesn't want. You know, how can this in one way or another just give people one more opportunity for agency? And you do it one teeny little thing at a time, and those teeny things do mushroom, to use a psychedelic word. Given history to date, am I optimistic or not, and why? I'm not optimistic or pessimistic because it's so futury. I'm not a futurist. I'm a presentist, right? So I'm not going to, it's not that it doesn't matter, but boy, this is turning so Jewy, but I'll do it anyway. Well, because of Ten Commands and all that. But there's this great medieval Jewish poem called the Unetane Tokef. And as a kid, I hated this thing. You read it on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And it's this one that says, between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, it is written, who will live and who will die? Who will be sick and who will be healthy? Who will have kids and who will lose their kids? Who will be at war? And it's like, and God is writing this, right? Everybody down there. And it's in there and it's sealed. And it's just, your fate is sealed. There's nothing you can do about it. But at the last two lines of the poem, it says, but through goodwill, charity, and mutual aid, we can lessen the severity of the decree. Right? Which means the severity means we can get through it. We can metabolize it together. That if we attend to each other, we can doula one another through whatever is coming. And to me, yes, it's important whether we're going to live or die, whether the climate's going to be healed or not. But the first job is to be present with one another in whatever's actually happening. And I think that that is the entry point to the kinds of collective action that we would need. It's a prerequisite to the solidarity that's going to be required to dig ourselves out of this hole. But I'm hopeful. I'm not optimistic or pessimistic. I'm kind of realistic that we're facing great challenges, and I'm kind of putting as much effort of my own as I can into being available to collectively metabolize the trauma we've been through, the trauma we're going through, and the trauma that we may go through, right, in order to be able to experience this reality as the bliss it can be.
There we go. Thank you so much. Everyone, make sure to get your book, Programmer Reprogrammed. Congratulations, Doug.
Thank you, Marissa. Thanks so much. And thanks, everybody, for coming. It's an honor to be celebrated here. Thanks.
You've been listening to Essential Dissent. This episode was a talk by Douglas Rushkoff in conversation with Marissa Feinberg. It took place at the Francis Kite Club in New York City on November 3, 2024. The Francis Kite Club is also the home of Orr Books, which recently published an updated edition of Douglas Rushkoff's book, Program or Be Programmed. I'm going to end with a clip from Caitlin Johnstone, read by Tim Foley. The title is, Biden's Legacy is Genocide, War, and Nuclear Brinkmanship. Thanks for listening, and remember, never believe anything until you hear the official denial.
Biden's legacy is genocide, war, and nuclear brinkmanship. That's all anyone should talk about when this psychopath finally dies. Anything positive he may have accomplished in his political career is a drop in the ocean compared to the significance of these mass-scale abuses. Biden spent his entire career promoting war and militarism at every opportunity, and then spent the twilight years of his time in Washington choosing to continue to supply an active genocide that is fully dependent on U.S.-supplied arms. He refused off-ramp after off-ramp to the horrific war in Ukraine that has burned through a generation of men in that country, which he knowingly provoked by amassing a military proxy threat on Russia's border in ways the U.S. would never tolerate being amassed on its own border. In the early weeks of the conflict, Biden and his fellow empire managers sabotaged peace talks to keep the war going for as long as possible with the goal of bleeding Moscow. And at one point, his own intelligence agencies reportedly assessed that the probability of a nuclear war erupting on this front was as high as 50-50. Coin toss odds on nuclear war. To call this a crime against humanity would be a massive understatement. Biden has been facilitating Israeli atrocities in the Middle East with U.S. military expansionism in the region and bombing operations in Yemen, Iraq, and Syria. He will spend his lame duck months backing Israel's scorched earth demolition of southern Lebanon. This is who Biden is. It is who he has always been. It is true that his brain has begun to rot away, just like his conscience has rotted. But in his lucid moments, he adamantly defends his administration's decisions as the only correct course of action, and it aligns perfectly with his past. To know this, one need only look at the pivotal role he played in pushing the Iraq invasion, or his extremist rhetoric about how if there were not an Israel, we'd have to invent one. This is the legacy that Democrats were forced to spend the last election cycle pretending is great and awesome. It's no wonder they lost. So now, as a parting gift from Joe Biden, Americans and the world get another 4 years of Donald Trump. That's the story of Joe Biden. That's the whole entire thing. Anything on top of that is irrelevant narrative fluff.